Available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is KBOO Portland, listener-powered, non-corporate community radio.
Dear listeners, I'm your host, Hedda. Thanks for tuning in to Preference. This is our Queer Boo slot, 6 to 7 on Tuesday evenings. Preference takes turns with trans positive. So tune in every Tuesday at 6 p.m. for our Queer Boo programs. We have a great show tonight. We're going to start with a syndicated program called Making Contact. It's going to be a discussion about intersex issues. And after that, we're mostly going to do some music, mostly the local folks, so I'm pretty excited. Let's get started with Making Contact.
This week on Making Contact.
I think it's one of those things where I speak on being intersex, like, so not just being a psychotherapist, but I'm also an activist and an educator. And when I mention that I am, you can see it in their eyes. They start thinking about what my genitals look like. And it becomes a process where I have to sort of like, oh, no, my eyes are up here, right? Like, we're having a conversation with a whole person. And not just that part of me. I am a breadth of experiences. This is one part of who I am. And the reason I'm talking to you today is because of that identity, but that's not the only thing about me.
I Am Because I Am explores the expansion of gender identity and presumed roles in our society. It looks beyond the socially constructed ideas of what is male, female, masculine, or feminine. Especially considering Trump's administration's attempt to redefine gender to be solely based on a person's genitalia at birth, thus potentially threatening transgender, intersex, and non-binary identity. In this show, we'll ask questions such as, what does it mean when individuals challenge specific societal expectations of gender? In the case of intersex individuals, how are these ideas of gender being debunked? And how are communities responding to the potential threat of erasure? I'm Anita Johnson, your host this week on Making Contact, a program connecting people, vital ideas, and important information. For most expecting mothers, the most frequently asked question is, what is the sex of the child that you'll soon give birth to? But what if that child is intersex? As many as 1.7% of people are born with genitals that cannot be easily categorized as male or female. That's roughly one out of every 1,500 live births, and as common as people with red hair. Nikki Khanna, an associate marriage and family therapist and intersex advocate, says gender is more than genitalia.
When a child is born, there's this like idea that it needs to be one or the other. And if there isn't a clear answer to that, it's often seen as a crisis, as being some sort of like terrible thing that's happened. And there are a few very rare occasions where there might be something else mentally going on that needs to be treated immediately. But the bigger issue is that it's just a cosmetic. They're just something like external with the body that doesn't match up with that idea of like what a little boy or a little girl is supposed to look like at birth. And then also it's seen as another sort of crisis, that a surgery needs to happen, that there's something different about this child or this person that needs to be corrected in order for them to be quote-unquote normal.
And now, with advances in the field of genetics and DNA, there seems to be at least 6 known biological sex genes. That's X, XX, XXY, XY, XYY, XXXY. Yes, it sounds a bit like high school biology, but all of these sex genes debunk the idea of what is normal. And despite this knowledge and despite an increasingly vocal intersex community, surgeries continue to happen. Traditionally in the West, when an intersex child is born, a doctor decides the sex of the child and performs surgery to conform to physical characteristics of male or female biological sex. Sean Seifer-Wall, a Black intersex man and intersex rights activist based in Atlanta, Georgia, believes the decision related to surgery is harmful and should be decided by the intersex person, not the physician.
When I was born, one of the traits or one of the characteristics of androgen insensitivity syndrome is undescended testes. And so when I was born, there was a couple of days when they didn't know how to assign my gender. So they decided that I would be raised as a girl. But they wanted to do surgery. They wanted to remove my testes. And my mom, she just didn't feel like it was right. So she made the decision that, you know, I would be raised with testes. Now, when I received my medical records at the age of 25, I requested them. And basically, the medical records showed, it is documented that it said that the mother has been told that the child has gonads, not testes, underline, and the child will be raised as a girl and will function as such. That is documented on my medical records. So I didn't know that I had internal testes. And when I was around 11 or 12, I had pain associated with my testes. And because of that pain at 13, they removed my testes. Now, up until then, I had no issues. And I think they could have actually, in hindsight, they could have just, I probably had hernias when I spoke to a doctor later in life. You know, I spoke to a doctor and the doctor said, you probably had hernias. They could have removed the hernias and you would have been fine. But they essentially threw out the baby with the bathwater. They removed my undescended testes, which is a source of hormones for me. And essentially, when they removed my testes, they put me on estrogen replacement therapy, which feminized my face and body, you know, and I identify as male now. So again, that wasn't the right decision.
Sean's story is just one of millions. Stories of parents who were not provided with a full description of how surgeries might affect their child down the road. Nikki Khanna, an intersex woman and activist, says that the omission of information is commonplace and that most parents are pressured to make a decision about surgery immediately following the birth of an intersex baby.
Well, I think one of the things that is the most common is that parents and the children themselves are told that they're the only one like that, that there aren't other people like this, that other people have these surgeries and have enjoyed the results and are happy with them. And they're not given information around how to contact other parents that have chosen different paths, how to be connected to other people who are intersex, other people who have similar conditions, other people who have made different decisions around their bodies. And so many parents are presented with, like, either you get surgery A or surgery B. And they're not presented with, you don't have to do anything. Like, no is not even an option presented to them. And they're not connected with support groups. Like, most doctors don't even know that there are support groups. There's been a long history of doctors discrediting support groups, referring to intersex activists as all being crazy and being extremists. You know, and it's not true. Like, there's this fear that, like, if you connect a child or parents with other children and parents, that there's some sort of danger in that. I mean, you would never do that if a kid had diabetes. Like, that's the first thing you would do is find support for that kid. If a child was born with Down syndrome, you know, child is autistic. Like, you connect them with parents and other people that have these similar conditions.
For both intersex advocates, Nikki and Sean, the issue of choice is central. They call for patient-centered models that not only include the parents and physician, but inform consent by the intersex person whose life will be most affected. And in order to bring about greater awareness, some intersex advocates embrace the panoply of the I and the LGBTQIA as a way of bringing intersex issues to the forefront of American consciousness. Again, Sean Seifer-Wall.
I feel like the LGBT community has given intersex people a platform to share their stories. Because I think for a long time, since this medical violence that has taken place, that has been done to intersex people, the medical community that includes urologists, surgeons, endocrinologists, and other physicians have not supported the stories and supported the experiences of people who have had these harmful medical interventions. And so essentially, I do feel that the LGBT community, particularly the trans community, has given intersex people a voice to share their stories. So that's why I think education is key.
With Trump's administration attempting to redefine gender to be based on a person's genitalia at birth, education is key now more than ever, for it could mean devastating consequences, not only for trans folks, but for intersex people as well. The restriction of the definition of gender could affect their ability to access human services, housing, education, and employment. Yet, despite these threats from Washington, the intersex movement against non-consensual medical interventions continues to grow. Amnesty International, the World Health Organization, and the state of California have formally denounced infant intersex surgeries, sending a clear message to the medical industry and government that intersex people should have the ability to decide what happens to their bodies in the same manner as anyone else. For Making Contact, I'm Anita Johnson. There is L, there is G, and B. And all of these sexual orientations that exist in and outside the lines drawn by those labels. What may not be as well known are the labels we choose to name gender identity and expression. That is, how we embody masculinity, femininity, or neither. Labels that may exist under the umbrella term transgender, transmasculine, transbutch, and transfemme, among others. Eden Annalie Luna manages the Transgender Economic Empowerment Project at the Los Angeles LGBT Center. With Eden's help, we get further clarification on the T.
I identify as trans feminine and non-binary. Trans feminine refers to the fact that I was assigned male at birth, but I'm transitioning to a feminine gender. And so I think with trans people, especially in the media and in movies and in the spotlight, there's this narrative of being born in the wrong body and transitioning to become in the right body. But for some trans people, they don't necessarily feel dysphoria. They don't necessarily feel that they're trapped in the wrong body. Rather, they just want the world to acknowledge them for who they are and how they express themselves. And non-binary refers to the fact that someone identifies with neither male or female, or neither man or woman, and that their identity can be either fluid, or they can be neutral, or they can be neither, or they can be all of the above. Non-binary is in some ways another umbrella term, kind of like the trans umbrella, that encapsulates any identities that don't fall in neatly within the two binary system.
You know, that's one of the things I've always wondered about. Just to be able to fully transition, if people wanted to, let's say, move forward with surgeries, they'd have to be diagnosed with some sort of a medical pathology, gender dysphoria, and then that's how they'd have to identify themselves.
That's always tricky to navigate, only because in some ways, I think it's great to have some kind of word to validate your feelings around your body and how you associate with your body. That may not always be the case for everyone else, and some people may have to say that they're experiencing dysphoria in order to access hormones or in order to access surgery, and that's always another issue. I've seen discussions online that in other countries, they would prefer to have it as a a condition or some kind of like pathologization to make the argument that for that reason there has to be treatment, or for that reason there has to be some kind of protection for their gender identity. But here in America, we're trying to expand, at least the trans community is trying to expand the definition of transitioning beyond just being labeled or associated with a condition of dysphoria.
So you've mentioned that a lot of the terminology around gender identity has been changing, and young people are taking on new terms all the time. Like, for instance, I'd never heard the term transfeminine before today. Can you tell me some of the other terms that have recently been added to the list?
Here's the thing, like, I think the list is ever expanding. And I think in some ways there is a list and there isn't a list, because for folks who do have access to the internet or who do speak English, they have access to channels like Facebook where people are actively having discussions or discourses around the trans umbrella and trans identity. So for me, just even discovering the word transfeminine was a journey. I didn't realize the term until maybe within the last 3-4 years. And then even then, I felt like it has been growing slowly, but surely more people have been using the word. I've also heard people use trans femme, and now we're seeing people use trans butch. And so with that context, we're still seeing in America, the language is at an incredible rate evolving. More and more people are coming out and changing the definitions of the word because they didn't feel like necessarily gay fit, or they didn't feel like bisexual fit or trans fit. And so we see more people using the word queer or demisexual or asexual or aromantic or biromantic or so on and so on. And then we also see that as well with gender identities. People are using words like trans feminine, trans masculine, trans femme, trans butch, and we see intersections of gender and sex in the ways that the culture has formed. I think it's important to acknowledge with the words femme and butch that this is coming from, in some ways, lesbian culture, where femme would be indicating someone maybe like a lipstick lesbian or someone who is in some ways more feminine presenting. Another end of the spectrum would be the butch expression. So butch is referring to, in some ways, a form of masculinity that isn't centered around being necessarily masculine. I think when we think of masculinity, we think of cisgender men who are aggressive or violent, whether that's catcalling or whether that's being abusive in relationships or being aggressive, whereas masculine can be a little negative or in some ways toxic, and being butch can be seen as more in some ways like a positive form of masculinity. That may be a reason why someone may use the words butch.
See, that's interesting because I've never heard that distinction made before, that people would choose to call themselves butch over masculine because of a negative connotation of masculinity. Because to me, masculinity is masculinity, whether it's positive or negative. And butch, in my mind, is synonymous with masculinity.
Just like how gay and trans means very different things for everyone from person to person, these are just some of the components why someone may use the word butch. And so when people use the words like trans femme or trans butch, in some ways they're indicating that they don't necessarily want to fit into what is womanhood or what is manhood, but rather they want to fit into this idea of masculinity or feminine energy. And they, in some ways, want to redefine what that means to them.
Earlier, we were talking about trans butch and trans femininity and how people might express their gender.
For so long, I think the narrative around trans bodies, especially trans men and trans women, is that we have to perform in some ways hyper feminine or hyper masculine in order to blend in. And in some ways, that never ends, because there will always be a trans woman who may blend in to what people may see or identify with womanhood. The moment they find out that she's trans, they're always going to have that chip on their shoulder about how they interact with her. And so because of that, some people may never come out as trans. And so people who are using trans femme and trans butch may be trying to expand what we define as masculine or feminine beyond having to go through the traditional trans narrative of having surgeries or having dysphoria diagnosed and so on. Like, in the narrative is that in order to be a trans man, you have to work out, or you have to like cars, or you have to like all these other things that men like. But that may not always be the truth for someone who is trans masculine.
To close, I want to get your personal opinion on the alphabet soup of LGBTQIA. It's interesting because on the one hand, you have straight people, and then there's everybody else. So even though we have this sort of nuanced, ever-expanding alphabet soup, it's a soup for everyone except straight people.
Yeah, I think living in this world that's centered around heterosexuality and cisgender people, I think we're always going to need labels. Whether someone doesn't necessarily feel like they need it personally or whether they choose not to be labeled. I think in our culture, we're going to need labels in order to find community and to find people who also identify that way. And so while labels can reinforce some of these ideas as well, like you're not gay enough, you're not trans enough, you're not bi enough, so on and so on, they can also invite or bring people into a culture that they've never heard of before. And so there's both beauty and pain associated with these labels.
We're here on Preference. Thanks so much for joining us tonight here on KBOO. Up next, we have Fake Zappa, also known as Jason T. Ingram, local artist. We've had him on the show in the past to discuss his experience in conversion therapy. We're going to hear a tune of his called Santa Bear. Santa Bear by Fake Zappa, a.k.a. Jason T. Ingram. We have Veronica Darling on the line. Veronica, can you hear us?
I can.
Wonderful. Thanks so much for joining us. You are board president of the Portland Lesbian Choir. Is that correct?
I am.
Wonderful. There's the choir is performing at the Grotto this Thursday, something that some folks are not excited about. I'll just as an aside, I'll tell a little story. I'm Jewish, and last night I was walking back to where I'm staying from Candy Babel on Alberta, and I passed St. Andrew on Alberta Street, and there were protesters outside, anti-gay, et cetera, the things that people accuse the Catholic Church of, and I thought, that's where I belong, in that service. I'd never done something like that before, and I think I've only been to one That was probably the fifth Christian service, and certainly the first Catholic that I've attended in my life. But it was welcoming, and I was glad to be there. It was a good feeling to walk up those steps with those folks behind, with their signs and their shouting. Anyway, the Grotto, tell us what's happening.
Well, first, our performance is Thursday, December 27th at 7 p.m., and we'll be performing pieces from our last concert in June, as well as some new ones, and I believe we have three small groups performing the various holiday music. And I think a few days before Christmas, we learned that there was a website or group that had written an article sort of lambasting the Grotto for including a lesbian choir and including a previous group called Without Apology that is a trans non-binary choir, and there's been responses to that, and we're prepared for it, but honestly, it sounds like a really small fringe group that's encouraging people to stay home rather than do anything disruptive. And the support we've gotten from the Grotto organization and from people excited to see the choir perform there is far outweighing anything negative.
Wonderful. Give us if you can, a little background on the choir itself.
The choir's been around since 1986 in Portland. I think it started out as sort of a sing-along group. Someone posted a note on a bulletin board asking if there were lesbians who wanted to sing together. Mm-hmm. And over the last 30-plus years, it's turned into a huge chorus. We regularly have more than, I think for the last three terms, last three seasons, we've had over 100 members. I think as high as 120 auditioning to sing, we are a non-audition choir, so arriving to sing at our open rehearsals, and we accept everyone, whether you identify as lesbian, gay, trans, non-binary, ally, it doesn't matter, but if you'd like to sing with us, you're welcome. And we put on two major concerts a year, and it's a wonderful, lovely place. I personally joined because I wanted to be in a space with queer people and just be able to enjoy music and get away from the week. And it's been a wonderful experience for me.
Wonderful. Thanks so much, Veronica. Thursday's concert at the Grotto, what time is it?
7 p.m. on Thursday, December 27th.
So it's inside then?
Yes.
All right. Veronica, we're going to hear the Portland Lesbian Choir perform Hope.
Yes.
Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Mm-hmm. I'm honored to introduce our next song. My family and I have been huge fans of Amy Steinberg for years. As a singer, songwriter, she has personally given me so much inspiration and hope in my darkest times. She helps us all see that there is good in this world, and there is always hope. I can't think of a time in my life when I felt like our country needed more hope than right now.
Thank you.
That was Portland Lesbian Choir performing Hope. They are singing this Thursday at the Grotto, 7 p.m., so we will see you there. And thanks to Veronica Darling for joining us to talk about the choir. Up next is a performance piece by Candy Royale. She was an Australian performance artist, poet, slam poet, a visual artist, many things. She was a wonderful, wonderful performance artist in so many genres. And she died earlier this year. I've been eager to do a little tribute to her. So we're going to hear a performance of hers right now.
Please welcome Candy Royale. Yay! I am my grandfather's memories of sunshine streaming through olive trees, of women sitting around and clucking like hens whilst they crush garlic with spices to make that night's meal. Their men tend gardens, plow the fields of their Baladi, their homeland. I am my grandfather's memories, remembering that he was raised as a Christian in a land of Muslims with Jewish friends. He played in the dirt with his future enemies, shared meals, and didn't yet know that history was in the making somewhere in Europe. I am my grandfather's memories and the things he doesn't even know yet. Like he was one of millions of pawns negotiated in a deal that would alleviate the guilt of the world for crimes committed that they had no hand in. There was no hatred yet. I am my grandfather's nightmare. Stories that came, horrors that caressed the ears of him, his parents, others in their community. It whispered that death was wiping out whole villages, that blood was being shed, so much that rivers ran upon the earth, turning it crimson. Violence was making the arid, land once fertile, wasted. I am my grandfather's nightmares, where he wished to be deaf to the stories of the Nakba, where to stay was to die, where to leave was to die. Death comes in many forms, and when your feet can no longer touch the ground you took your first steps upon, that's a form of death too. I am my grandfather's nightmares of the stories coming closer, of terror being sowed whilst the peasants ploughed the land. He thought of the danger his aging parents were in. He thought of his own life ahead of him. He'd seen his people torn from the earth. No more roots, they wandered out days, confused, crying for their losses, mourning the dead, asking Allah what they did to deserve this. He'd seen whole villages razed to the ground, and he knew that a knock on the door was imminent, that the violence ravaging his land would not stop. In fact, it intensified daily, and so, knowing under occupation is no place to live, he left one day, saying goodbye to his parents. He swore he would send for them once he had found somewhere safe. I am my grandfather's memories as he stepped out that door one last time, held his hand up to shield his eyes, breathed in slow through his nostrils, and forced himself to remember every smell. He opened his eyes wide, allowed them to sting, and looked upon his village one last time. He forced himself to remember every sight. Then he closed his eyes and committed to memory all those memories before 1948, so that he would leave in love and not hate. Opening his eyes, I am his memory of walking away of the crunch of dirt beneath his feet, of the earth's conversations with him, how the wind wished him well through the trees, and he responded with his heart. Knowing he could never return, he swore to his homeland it would reside forever inside. I am my grandfather's memories as he immigrated to Lebanon to try to start again. How he worked long hours as a refugee in a foreign land, trying to gather the money required to save his parents from the death which was beckoning. I am my grandfather's memories as he managed to bring his parents over then start his own family. Getting married, having children, tragically losing a wife, getting married again, having more children and trying to provide for them. I am my father's memories of being born into a displaced family where the home land is referred to constantly, where he had this sense that he belonged elsewhere, where the injustice was keenly felt, where the world seemed not to care nor understand the plight of his people. I am my father's memories of a family striving to survive, always on the outside, and he as a child growing in another war-torn country, but knowing that he would leave before the army could get to him. I am my father's memories of being kidnapped twice, and twice being set free, for he did not subscribe to any form of religious extremism. I am my father's memories of constant warfare, being shot by rubber bullets, choking on tear gas, listening to missiles soar overhead, and hoping against all hope that their bullet-riddled apartment block would not be hit next. I am my father's memories of being 18 and knowing if he did not leave, he'd have to bear a weapon and the death that comes with it, either behind it or in front of it. So he left that land, knowing he could never return. He became a deserter of a war he did not agree with. As his plane ascended toward the heavens, I am his memories of hope for a better future and sadness that he may never see those whom he loves again. I am my father's memories of picking grapes in France, trying to get enough money to get further away. I am my father's memories of boarding a plane for Australia where he knew my mother to be and tearing up his passport, arriving as a refugee. I am my own memory of being 8 or 9 years old and listening to the voice of my grandfather on a tape he sent us from a land I can barely imagine, but whose food I eat, whose music I hear, whose history I am already learning. I am my own memory of being 10 or 11 years old and seeing my dad cry for the first time. My father knew his father was dying but couldn't return. He didn't get to say goodbye to his barber on his deathbed. That's when I became my grandfather's memories. You see, he could no longer remember now that he'd been buried. I am my own memory of being this teenager and struggling to exist between two cultures, one which sought me to hang on to a past and one which forced me into the future, one which sought to fill me with love and one which forced me to belong to this land. I am my own memory of trying to understand why my father was always so angry until I was old enough to see that where once my father had been a warrior, he was now nothing more than a warrior, and I mistook that fear at losing his land, his family, everything I took for granted, for anger. I am my family's blood, where these memories, these histories course through my veins, where my own feet have not yet touched the soil of where my grandfather and my father's footsteps roamed. I am the memories of the displaced, the lost, the hidden, the lies, the propaganda. I am the memories of blue sky, dry heat, homeless, tabbouleh, tabla. I am the memories of that lost land and this land gained.
That was Candy Royale. Rest in peace, Candy. Up next, we're going to play De L'Amour. This is a song that dozens of French artists collaborated on. It's a charity fundraising song. It raises funds for Urgence Homophobie, Homophobia Emergency. And the song tells the story of queer refugee Azamat, who was the first refugee that this charity helped escape persecution in his home country. This song's just released this week, so let's take a listen to De L'Amour.
Demain je serai déjà loin. Je disparais mais je n'oublie rien. Je n'oublie rien. Je laisse ma vie derrière moi. En quelques secondes, tout s'en va. Tout s'en va. De l'amour à chaque instant et chaque jour. De l'amour
sans limite et sans retour.
De l'amour, celui qu'on peut vivre en grand jour. De l'amour, de l'amour. Bonjour. De l'amour, de l'amour, de l'amour. Je marche enfin dans Paris. Je n'ai plus peur d'être qui je suis. Qui je suis. Je m'inquiète pour mes amis. Ils sont perdus dans mon pays. Mon pays.
De l'amour à chaque instant et chaque jour.
De l'amour
sans limite et sans retour.
De l'amour,
celui qu'on peut vivre au grand jour.
De l'amour, de l'amour.
Celui qu'on peut vivre au grand jour.
De l'amour, de l'amour.
Dis, pourquoi moi?
Je ne comprends pas
ce monde-là. Non, plus jamais ça.
Je t'envoie.
De l'amour
à chaque instant et chaque jour.
De l'amour
sans limite et sans retour.
De l'amour,
celui qu'on peut vivre au grand jour.
De l'amour, de l'amour.
Partout dans le monde, les personnes homosexuelles ou transgenres sont encore victimes de violences. Aidons-les sur urgencehomophobie.com. Leur histoire, c'est notre histoire.
That was De L'Amour. More information on the web. Dozens of French artists collaborated on that beautiful piece to raise funds to fight homophobia. We're going to close out the hour with This Way Out, a syndicated program covering national and international gay, lesbian, trans issues. After the hour turns, Calculated Conversation will be on. Thanks so much. This has been Preference, and I've been your host, Hedda, and thanks to Liam for keeping things running tonight.
The Trump administration is trying to undo much of our progress, so it's more important than ever to elect more people who will advance the movement towards our nation's promise of equality for all.
And then you have Jim Kepner's International Gay and Lesbian Archive. And Kepner, hey, I like to call him our Moses. He was found as an infant under an oleander bush in Texas.
You're not kidding.
No, I'm not kidding.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappell. Bermuda files final appeal to protect inequality, electoral math and the future of queer rights, and preserving a one-of-a-kind archive. All that and more this week because you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Monique Lukens.
And I'm Christopher Gall.
With News Wrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending December 15th, 2018. Bermuda's government has decided to go to the mat over marriage equality. It filed an appeal on December 13th with the UK Privy Council, the only remaining challenge it has left to an original Supreme Court ruling in May 2017 opening civil marriage on the island to same-gender couples. Lawmakers overturned that decision by creating separate, but what they called equal, domestic partnerships that became law in February of this year. The Supreme Court then struck that legislation down as unconstitutional discrimination 4 months later and reinstated marriage equality. Carnival Cruises, an industry leader flying Bermuda's flag, had to cancel several advance bookings for romantic weddings at sea for gay and lesbian couples after lawmakers re-banned marriage equality. They joined LGBTQ rights groups in the fight against inequality on the tourism-dependent island by offering financial as well as moral support. Bermuda's Court of Appeal, for which foreign judges are empaneled, upheld that second Supreme Court decision in a ruling issued on November 23rd. The UK Privy Council is the highest court of appeal for Bermuda and all other British overseas territories.
Bermuda's government explained its rationale for the appeal in a statement that read, in part, "Constitutional issues are important issues, and this government wants to get it right." But local rights activist Tony Brannan told Reuters that this is a cynical, bigoted, hypocritical attack on the rights and freedoms of others. Further waste of taxpayer dollars is obscene and repugnant. There's been no word to date about whether or not the Privy Council would agree to even consider the appeal. If they do, it could be several months before a hearing is convened. Meanwhile, according to leading attorney Mark Pettengill, a longtime champion of marriage equality, same-gender couples can continue to legally wed on the island or on cruise ships flying Bermuda's flag unless the Privy Council issues a stay of the Court of Appeal decision, which he doesn't think will happen. Analysts believe an eventual council ruling for marriage equality, which most say is likely, could impact other British overseas territories, which currently refuse to open the institution to same-gender couples.
A unanimous three-judge panel of Israel's High Court of Justice ruled this week that both members of a same-gender couple who adopt children together must be listed as the parents on the child's birth certificate. The case was brought by a gay male couple who had adopted a son together. Israel's Interior Ministry refused to put both their names on the birth certificate, which meant that only one parent was legally able to make decisions involving their son. Justice Neil Hendel wrote for the panel that the law doesn't permit us to limit ourselves to only one of his parents in the birth certificate, adding that it is unreasonable for the couple to be recognized as parents, but for the certificate not to give expression to that fact. According to the Haaretz newspaper, the ruling is expected to impact two pending cases, one brought by a lesbian couple seeking to have both their names on the birth certificate of one of the women's biological child, and another filed by a transgender man seeking to be listed as the father rather than the mother on his child's birth certificate. A statement issued by the attorneys for the successful gay couple said that, "We're happy that the court reminded the Interior Ministry of something that should have been self-evident, that parents are parents, no matter their sex, sexual orientation, or gender.
LGBTQ refugees in Kenya's sprawling Kakuma camp in the country's northwestern Turkana County are being moved to safe houses in Nairobi after fellow refugees assaulted them, with local police officers joining in, as they held a peaceful march to the UN Refugee Agency on December 11th to demand better protection. There have been several assaults against sexual and gender minorities in the camp since a few brave souls held a pride event in June, and a number of queer refugees have had their shelters set on fire. According to Reuters, the camp houses at least 185,000 refugees from more than 10 countries. At least 24 queer refugees were viciously beaten during that December 11th march to the UN, with some requiring hospitalization. Another was stabbed 2 days later. A spokeswoman for the UN Refugee Agency said that the LGBTI refugees who were involved in these incidents would be better protected outside Kakuma. The necessary measures have been taken to facilitate their removal. She said most of the other estimated 170 at-risk queer refugees would be moved by the end of the month. With the major exception of South Africa, most countries on the African continent criminalize consensual adult gay sex. It's punishable in Kenya by up to 14 years in prison. But that's still not as bad as the climate in neighboring Uganda and Tanzania. The UN agency in Kenya says it's registered more than 750 LGBTI refugees, many from those two countries. Queer refugees in the Central American caravan who've reached the Mexican border town of Tijuana, Donald Trump calls it an invasion, are facing similar homophobic hostility.
Brazil's far-right president-elect Jair Bolsonaro is showing his true colors. He was elected on an anti-corruption campaign, not coincidentally the number one concern of voters, according to many polls. But he's surrounding himself with a similarly autocratic cabinet, many bringing corruption baggage with them. His chief of staff designee confessed to getting kickbacks from one of the world's largest meat processors, but was never prosecuted. His vice presidential running mate was linked to a public official convicted of tax evasion and looting public funds. Bolsonaro's soon-to-be Secretary of the Economy is under two separate investigations for fraud, and his choice for Secretary of Health is being investigated for influence peddling, fraud, and bribery. Bolsonaro proudly proclaimed his homophobia during the campaign, saying that he'd rather have a dead son than a gay son. He's abolishing the Human Rights Ministry, naming Damaris Alves, an evangelical preacher, to head up a newly created ministry for women, family, human rights, and the country's 900,000 indigenous people. She opposes a woman's right to choose and believes that women are born to be mothers, which has alarmed feminists. Bolsonaro's intention to open the Amazon to commercial mining has also alarmed environmentalists and advocates for indigenous people. And LGBTQ activists fear that his administration will oppose any efforts to advance their rights and pay only lip service to human rights in general.
In other news, the gay cowboy romantic tragedy Brokeback Mountain has been designated for preservation by the U.S. Library of Congress. Directed by Ang Lee and starring Jake Gyllenhaal and the late Heath Ledger, it won 3 Academy Awards, Best Director, Best Adapted Screenplay, and Best Original Score. Each year, the Library of Congress names 25 motion pictures to the National Film Registry that are culturally, historically, or aesthetically significant. The films must be at least 10 years old. Brokeback Mountain, released in 2005, was selected this year, along with, among others, Stanley Kubrick's The Shining, the cinematic version of My Fair Lady, and Jurassic Park. Alfred Hitchcock's 1940 film Rebecca was also added, which queer critics say hints at a homoerotic relationship between the characters of Mrs. Danvers and Rebecca that Hollywood censorship of the time prevented from being more apparent. A statement issued by the Library of Congress said Brokeback Mountain is haunting in its unsentimental depiction of longing, lonesomeness, pretense, sexual repression, and ultimately love. At the time, Newsweek film critic David Anson called it a watershed in mainstream movies, the first gay love story with A-list Hollywood stars.
And finally,
is this the real life? Is this just fantasy?
Bohemian Rhapsody by Queen, fronted by bisexual lead singer Freddie Mercury, has been named the biggest hit of the 20th century, based on more than 1.6 billion plays around the world on all major streaming services. Universal Music Group, which licenses all of Queen's music outside North America, announced the singular accomplishment this week. CEO Sir Lucian Grange called it an incredible achievement that is a testament to the enduring brilliance of Queen. The momentous accomplishment was no doubt bolstered by the movie Bohemian Rhapsody, featuring an Oscar-worthy performance by Rami Malek as Freddie, which in just 5 weeks became the biggest-grossing music biopic of all time. The iconic song, first released in October 1975, gained renewed popularity when it was featured in the hit 1992 movie comedy Wayne's World. It was Queen's first top 10 hit in the U.S., topped the U.K. charts for 9 consecutive weeks, and is the only song in history to have reached number 1 on the U.K. charts during 2 different year-ending holiday seasons.
That's News Wrap, global queer news with attitude for the week ending December 15th, 2018. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap is written by Greg Gordon, produced with Brian DeShazer, recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles, and brought to you by you.
Help keep us in ears around the world at the ever-updating thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Christopher Gall.
And I'm Monique Lukens.
Hi, this is John Schuck, host of Progressive Spirit. This week I speak with Dr. Aisha Juman about the humanitarian crisis in Yemen.
You know, what is sad for me as a Yemeni American, it's heartbreaking for me when I go to Yemen. And what the people see, they say without the U.S. support, the Saudi cannot conduct this war. So they consider this war an American war.
Listen to weekly podcasts on kboo.fm/progressive spirit.
KBOO is excited to be part of the 2018 Willamette Week Give Guide. This year, Willamette Week and KBOO are challenging our community to give with their dollars and take action by showing up in real life. KBOO has been showing up for over 50 years. Give to KBOO today and you get full access to the Chinook Book app, plus freebies from Laughing Planet, Gluten Free Gem, Wii Press, and Nosa Familia Coffee. You can contribute right now at kboo.fm/give or call 503-231-8032. Support KBOO, where music makes the movement.
This is KBOO Portland.